Subscribe to the Hit That Line Podcast Network, brought to you by Breeden RV Center. Breeden RV Center, family-owned and operated, a no-pressure, laid-back atmosphere, and always home of the free maintenance for life.
No matter what the stats may say, and the experts may think, and the commentators may have predicted, when the race is on, all bets are off. Don't be surprised if somebody decides to flip the script and take a pass on yelling uncle. And then suddenly, as the old saying goes, we got ourselves a game.
This is Trusting the Process.
We have made it all the way to Season 1, Episode 8 of Trusting the Process. I'm Todd Richardson, and I am pleased to be joined by a friend, a coworker, and a guy that I've gotten to know in this industry the last few years, Mr. Clay Henry, the publisher of Fogs Illustrated. Now, Clay, I appreciate you joining us. I know we got some good fishing weather today, so I appreciate you taking some time with us, man.
Well, I'm glad to do it, Ty. It's going to be fun.
I want to start kind of where you grew up, and I've talked to people about this. I think you've referenced it on the show that you either lived on War Memorial or lived next to War Memorial. What are some of the pranks that you played on different golfers at War Memorial Golf?
So Markham Street is across from the stadium, and where the Wendy's is now was originally a house, just a A-frame house, and that's where my family lived when I was born. Lived there only a few years. I don't remember that. Then we lived out in Meadowcliff in southwest Little Rock till I was in the third grade. And then the house that I really grew up in is 1821 Fair Park. The house is two-story red brick house on the corner of a stop sign, Fair Park Boulevard. That's about 10 or 12 blocks from really the, you know, what I call the park. And that's War Memorial Park Golf Course, the stadium, Ray Winder Field, and then there was a swimming pool. And all of that is kind of was my growing up area. And in those days, you could walk. You could go anywhere you wanted to. I walked to Ray Winder Field, worked there as a Reno the ball man's ball guy. When I was six or seven, I would sit there, and the foul balls that went up the screen at Ray Winder, I'd run out there with my glove, and the crowd would go whoop, whoop as the ball went, and I'd catch it, and then he'd take it back to Reno. And he took the balls to the umpire. So I did that for two or three summers. I think I got $2 a game to be Reno the ball man's ball boy. And you sit right by the visitor's dugout, so I got to see a lot of great professional players like Steve Garvey, Ron Say, you know, all the guys that were playing in the Dodger system is the ones that I remember, because they made it to the major leagues and never came back. But grew up playing golf. Some of it was at War Memorial Park, but my dad's younger brother, Bill, built Western Hills Golf Course and then rented Riverdale from the Rockefeller family. And that was my high school days. So that's where I really learned to play golf. But we would play some as kids at War Memorial Park. And you could drive and walk over there, carry your bag. And you could get on in the afternoon for, I think it was $1.15. Mm-hmm. You had to wait till, you know, all the adults had started, and then you could play till dark. So I did that. And what I really remember is the walk home. There's a watermelon stand at 12th and Fair Park. And for a quarter, you could get half a watermelon and sit there and eat the watermelon. And that kind of
would you eat the
reload
whole thing?
You. Yeah.
You'd eat the whole thing?
No, I'd eat my half. You know, my brothers would get everybody would get a half.
Okay.
They weren't like massive watermelon size. So a half for 14-year-olds, it wasn't a lot of watermelon. My mother had a rule, you couldn't have watermelon after 8 o'clock because she thought you'd wet the bed if you did. So that was nobody ever did, but that was her rule.
Okay. Yeah, that's probably a good rule to have. I enjoyed the watermelon when I was working landscaping one summer. It definitely helps. Now, you were mentioning some of the professional players, Clay, when you were a ball boy at Ray Winder, and I was unaware of this, but you actually caught for Gerald Hannis back in the day. Now, that's Dusty's dad, for those who don't know, had a successful major league career. When was that, at Central, or when was
No, so we were actually rivals in high school. He went to Hall and I went to Central. And now I only played 1 year of Legion ball. And I played as a 16-year-old and made the Colonial Bread team and played, and you know, that was one of the stronger teams in Little Rock. And a 16-year-old didn't get to play regularly. I played some, but I was I played second base, a little outfield, and was the backup catcher. And you know, and Tommy Oakley was our regular catcher, who was an 18-year-old. But Gerald was, you know, 6'4", 6'5", and he threw 92 to 95. And he had a devastating 12-6 curveball. I mean, he danced that one up just behind the plate. You know, you'd have to block it. And I got into some games catching, and I'll never forget. It was, I think Tommy had gotten hurt, and I was in the game. And Gerald called. It was in the last inning. We were up. There was a runner on third, which made me nervous because he would throw it in the dirt, you know, like a breaker in the dirt for the last strike.
Yeah.
And he called me out to the mound. He says, "We're going to run the fake pass ball." Now, Ty, have you ever heard of the fake pass ball before?
It's where you act like the ball got behind you, but in reality you have it. Is that right?
Yeah, yeah. He'd throw it in the dirt. I smothered it, and I turned, ducked around the umpire and started sprinting for the screen. This was at Kern-Conway Field. The runner broke from third. I fired it to Gerald. He threw it to the third baseman, and they got him out. And we come off the field, and our coach is like, "What was that?" And I wasn't going to say a word. I'm 16. I just looked at Gerald, and he says, "Clay called the fake pass ball." He came out to the mound.
He pinned it on you.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Oh, yeah. And he just looked at me, and he goes, "We don't do that."
Wow.
And, I was telling Van Horn that one time, and he's like, "Really? Y'all did that?" I said, "That's Hannis. I mean, he's a crazy, crazy dude." So, but the real – I probably spent more time warming him up than – you know, then really, you know, game action.
Yeah.
Because I'd go down to warm him up before the game. Or in between innings, you know, the catcher's putting on his gear. You've got to go out there and get the pitcher warmed up. And he loved to throw knuckleballs in warm-ups. And he wouldn't throw a knuckleball in a game.
Just warm-ups?
But he would warm it, and you can't catch it. I mean, I had bruises on my body, and he just would just be laughing. He thought that was hilarious. We've talked about that through the years, and he goes, "Yeah, I don't know why I did that." I said, "Because you're ornery." I mean, but he's a great guy. I mean, great relationship with him through the years. And if you ever play together and you go, you know, through battles, you know, that's the camaraderie that never leaves you. You know, just the guys that you played baseball or basketball. Yeah, you know, I played basketball with Fred Allen at Little Rock Central. We were on the same team as 10th graders, made the varsity, and he started on the varsity.
Mm-hmm.
And he's in the State House now. I think he's a state rep, and I saw him at our basketball reunion. It's like we'd never been apart. I hadn't seen him in, you know, 45, 50 years. So those are the things that, you know, just the crap that you went through and practices and things, they don't go away.
And that's why
you asked me about pranks, and I got sidetracked. I'm sorry. The best prank that we ever pulled, and this was me and Paul Burton, and Paul's a dentist in Little Rock now, and we grew up same neighborhood, played on the golf team at Little Rock Central and played basketball together. He's a better football player than anything else. But the 14th at War Memorial, of course, the course is is doesn't exist anymore. It's just grassed in now. But it's a blind tee shot over a hill towards the zoo, and the green is right by the green, and there's a culvert, a drainage culvert, right behind the green. And if you're little, you could crawl into that culvert and hide. Well, you know, you tee off over the hill about 260, 270, and you had to be careful. You could drive it too far and be out of bounds in the road.
Yeah.
And it comes down the hill, and then now and then there'd be a ball up on the green. Well, usually never more than one, sometimes two. But our prank was to take the golf balls from off the front of the green and stick them in the hole.
Oh, man.
And then you would hide in the culvert and listen to people. I mean, there's never been four hole-in-ones, right? And, like, listen to them kind of, okay, who's going to claim this one? Well, you know, it's – and then you look in the paper the next day to see if anybody claimed a hole-in-one on number 14.
How often would they claim it?
Almost every time.
Every time?
Yeah.
Wow.
And none of them ever made one.
Have you ever made a hole-in-one?
Three.
Yep. Okay. My grandpa made five, so he's got you beat.
Yeah. Well, that's a lot. You know, you're lucky to make one. And I made there's one that there are going to be a few people that can match it, you know, but I was 22 and spent 2 weeks summer vacation with my Uncle Travis in Arlington, Virginia. He was a lobbyist in Congress. And every morning he'd take me to the Smithsonian, drop me off in front of one of the buildings, and I would spend the whole morning going through the Smithsonian, and then he'd pick me up at lunch, and we'd go to the press club and have lunch, and then we'd go play his club, a round of golf in the afternoon. And that was right after I'd finished playing golf at UCA, and I was decent. And my favorite club was a one iron. I drove with it, used it on long par threes, and I aced the 10th at Arlington Country Club, 223. And it went in on the fly. So,
oh, wow.
The real fun part was after we were through, he went into the pro shop, and of course, no cell phones, and he borrowed the pro's phone, and he called the Gazette sports staff with a collect call to my dad. And my dad answered, and he goes, "You're calling in a hole in one." And he's like, "Well, how'd you know?" And he says, "Be the only reason you'd make a collect phone call." So, you know, the two brothers worked it out, and it was, you know, if you make a hole in one at a club, you buy drinks, right? And the bar tab was around $800, and I thought, boy, this is bad.
Not doing this again.
My Uncle Travis is like, "No, you're not paying for anything on this trip." And I later found out that my dad paid that tab.
What? And remind me what year it was.
Oh, it would have been, let's see, probably around 75, 76.
So you and your boy spent $800 back?
I didn't. I mean, the whole club did. I mean,
man.
You buy drinks for everybody in the bar.
Okay, so it's not
yours. That's the deal. No, it's not yours. I mean, I probably didn't have an alcoholic drink at that setting.
Okay. I thought it was just like your crew that you were with.
Nope. No, it was just me and him playing. You buy drinks for everybody in the bar. I mean, different clubs do it different ways, but that's traditional. If anybody that's in there is going to get a free drink on you.
And
a lot of places, they have hole-in-one insurance, so you pay $5 every time somebody makes a hole-in-one, and it covers the bar tab. So
another golf story that I know you like to reflect on is the group that your dad used to be a part of. And Paul Eels, first time, tried to take a mulligan, and your dad, Jim Bailey, and I don't remember if it was Jim Elder.
No, it was, so Bailey didn't play golf, so okay. It wasn't Bailey. The group was, the regular group was Jim Elder,
okay.
Paul wasn't in it until then, Harry King, and my dad. That was the regular threesome. When Paul came to town, he joined the group. And first hole at North Hills, par five, not a difficult hole. And Paul hits one a little bit down the left side. It might have trickled into the rough, but it was not a problem. And he reaches in his back pocket for another ball, and my dad's at the back of the tee, and he goes, I mean, they just had met. Paul hadn't been in town very long. And my dad says, Paul, are you going to play or are you going to practice? And Harry and Jim were just rolling on the ground because they knew that was coming. I mean, they didn't take any mulligans. And they putted out every putt, no gimmies. So, Paul.
Real golf.
Paul put his ball back in his pocket, yeah.
So how early did you get involved in golf? I know you eventually college golf for UCA.
Oh, well, so, you know, my dad's in the Arkansas Golf Hall of Fame because of his golf coverage. But he grew up as a caddy at Warmoil Park. All of his brothers, three of them are golf pros. One of his brother-in-laws was a golf pro, was the greenskeeper at Warmoil Park. So golf was always a part of our lives. And when I was 4 or 5, I can remember going to Western Hills and taking lessons from my Uncle Bill. And it would be a group setting. All the junior golfers at Western Hills would be lined up on the tee. And I got to be part of that, as did my brothers. And then I remember playing in the, I think it was on a Tuesday afternoon, they would have a 3-hole group, a 5-hole group, and a 9-hole group for the juniors. And I remember winning a Doug Sanders golf ball for winning the 3-hole group. I couldn't have been very old, you know, as maybe a 4th or 5th grader. So I started playing as soon as I was big enough to hold a club. You know, Dad had cut down clubs for all of us. So, yeah, but golf has just been the thing that was just a constant in my life. And then as a Tulsa World reporter, I wrote a golf column once a week. I mean, I wrote it 52 weeks of the year, had a golf column in the paper, just straight golf.
So you brought up the Tulsa World. Was that your first writing job out of college?
No. So I started working at the Gazette when I was 16, yeah. And they didn't call me copy boy, but that's kind of what I was. Worked in the sports department, answered the phone, you know, shuffled copy around to the back shop, did, you know, went and got dinner for people. I mean, you just did filed pictures. And I probably started filing pictures there when I was 13 or 14. I'd be down there on a Saturday afternoon, and my dad would give me a stack of pictures to file from the week. And I'd have to ID them on the back and then file them. And so as a 17-year-old, I started getting 3 to 4 days a week at the Gazette. And as an 18-year-old, I worked 5 days a week, 40 hours at nights, and basically stacked up money for college. Went to the U of A for 1 year and then transferred to UCA. The summer between my freshman and sophomore year, my mom had a stroke, mm-hmm. and she never came home. She spent the rest of her life institutionalized. And at the end, I was her guardian. After my dad had passed, she was still, you know, in that state. So I didn't go back to the U of A. I played in some golf tournaments that summer and did really well in amateur golf, state amateur. I didn't win them, but I finished high. And I got a call that I would be given a golf scholarship at UCA. And the coach, who was also the athletic director, says, you can live at home this first semester and just take classes 3 days a week. So I lived at home and helped my dad with my younger brother and worked at nights at the Gazette full time. And then that spring, I moved into the dorm at UCA and played on the golf team for 2 years. And after college, my first job, I'd worked all the way through college, working nights at the Gazette. And there was an opening at the Log Cabin Democrat, the Conway paper, and I applied and followed John Brummett as the sports editor at the Log Cabin Democrat. Did that for 3 years.
John Brummett, wow.
And then at 25, I was hired at the Tulsa World. So that's kind of the, so it's like, when did you start in the newspaper business? Well, it just seems like, as soon as I was old enough to drive, that's what I've been doing.
For all you youngins, listen, it always helps to start as early as possible. I'm not even middle school, high school, whatever you're in, you want to start early. Now, Clay, your time in Tulsa, you got to come or some incredible athletes, incredible coaches, the Selman brothers, Barry Switzer, Jimmy Johnson.
Yeah, Selman brothers were before me. They predated me by about 4 or 5 years, but I know them okay. because they would be around at OU, and I'd, you know, back from their pro days. And I'd been to Eufaula and done some stories, but I didn't actually cover them in college. Go ahead. I interrupted you.
No, you're good. No, we want the accurate information on
yep.
here. So let me make sure I'm right. I know you've talked about Switzer. I know you've talked about Jimmy Johnson. Nolan Richardson was at Tulsa. Are those three?
Yeah,
ones?
So when I got there in 78, the head coaches, and they did what they called the Big Four. At that particular time, the Tulsa World was the best paper in Northwest Arkansas. They had daily delivery of their city edition, which got all the West Coast box scores. So they delivered papers, a later edition in Northwest Arkansas, because the mall owners in Tulsa wanted papers, they're advertising to go to Northwest Arkansas. So they covered on a daily basis the same amount of coverage to OU, OSU, Tulsa, and Arkansas. So the coaches that I covered, and we didn't have beats, you just swap schools every week. So you covered all four of them, which was unique. So Switzer was at head coach at Oklahoma. And of course, you know, he knew who I was. He knew my father. My father was the speaker at his high school senior banquet.
Oh, wow.
In Crossett. So he knew my dad when he played and coached at Arkansas too. Then Jimmy Johnson was Oklahoma State. He knew me. John Cooper was at Tulsa. He would later be head coach at Ohio State, and is still a good friend. I get messages from emails and texts from him. And Lou Holtz was at Arkansas. So that's the coaches that I got to cover. And in those days, you could watch practice, and it didn't really matter, you know, who was in the stands. They didn't care. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, now everything is behind closed doors.
Screw them. This is your time. Now go out there and take it.
You're listening to Trusting the Process.
So you brought up your dad, and I think everyone listening knows who Orville Henry is. I know my dad was really excited for this because he read your dad's stuff. He reads your stuff. My grandpa read your stuff. His grandpa read your stuff. There's just a lot of connections there. And Clay, I don't think I've ever asked you this, but a lot of – and like I don't know if Jack and Joe Buck is the right comparison. Let's think Arkansas connection, Jack and Joe Buck. For one sec, I wonder from your perspective, you mentioned those coaches that knew your dad, knew his reputation, it's about stellar as it gets. It was probably a help as a lot of occasion, but did you ever feel like it was a hindrance no matter how good of work you did, no matter how much effort you put into something? It was never, and I'm putting air quotes right now, you can't see me, it was never up to the expectations of Orville. Was there a dynamic there at all growing up, especially since you guys entered the same world?
No, that's, first of all, the best thing, I can remember when the job opening, I got the call from Bill Connors, I called my dad, because I thought my destiny would be to work at the Arkansas Gazette.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, Clay, there, you know, we've got nepotism rules. And as long as you were just, quote, part-time, and I went way beyond part-time when I was in college there. I mean, I covered games. I did everything you could do except be full-time. And the salary was good, too. And I said, well, I'm out of college. I've done 3 years at the log cabin. I thought eventually I'd come back, you know, to work for you. And he says, not going to happen. He says, you need to take that job in Tulsa, and you need to get as far away from Arkansas as you can and be comfortable. And it was great advice. And so what I did for 14 years is very few people knew or referred to me as Orville Henry's son in Oklahoma. You know, when I come to cover Razorback games, and often I sit beside my dad in the press box. That was the seat assignment. The Tulsa World and the Arkansas Gazette were side by side, 50-yard line. So I'd get to see my dad three or four times, you know, in work settings, which was good and fun for him and for me. And but I had 14 years to kind of build my own reputation, and that was good. And no pressure to be a legend's son in the same profession. Every once in a while, there would be some mention, hey, that was like your dad would write or something like that, and I would smile. But that was always my goal, is to be the best, and that's what he was. Now, the lucky part is I worked for someone that was just like my dad in same reputation. Bill Connors, who was a sports editor at the Tulsa World for, 40 years, hired me and mentored me and molded me and probably gave me more guidance in the business than my dad did. I watched my dad, but he didn't coach me or he let the other people, you know, the staffers at the newspaper like Jim Bailey do that. So, you know, it wasn't like he was, you know, he might read a story and say that was good. He never criticized, never said anything about my work. And then occasionally I'd get a message about a story that I'd done in the Tulsa World. Hey, I saw that. That's good work. And that would make me beam, you know, to hear that from him. But it was more from, you know, what Bill Connors taught me than probably my father. But, you know, when I started Hogs Illustrated, that was different, because then I was writing and to the same audience that my dad, and that was pressure that I wanted to be quality. And I did not want to embarrass my father. And so there was pressure there. But, you know, the folks at the U of A, you know, whether it be Coach Burles, you know, working with Rick Schaefer or Kevin Trainer, never heard anything like that from either, you know, coaches or players. And you know, I've got a lot of friends, you know, in coaching that, you know, my dad covered that I end up covering, you know, like a Harold Horton or a Lewis Campbell. And those are really good friends. And so, you know, it makes me feel good when they say something like, we like that, or we read that, and it reminds, you know, of your dad's work. And I'm not saying that happens real often, but when it does, you kind of perk up.
You beam a little bit. So let's talk about Hogs Illustrated. We're talking with Clay Henry, the publisher of Hogs Illustrated, Season 1, Episode 8 of Trusting the Process. Clay, I read that piece again of you just kind of going back and talking about how pivotal 94 was to Hogs Illustrated, Hogs winning the national championship, how your dad was kind of unsure, hey, you have a good job at the Tulsa World right now, might want to stay put. What were those conversations like with Bill Connors, your dad, leading up to you coming back to Arkansas and starting Hogs Illustrated?
Yeah, so it's kind of interesting. It really was a dilemma because I had a good job. I was deacon at Southern Hills Baptist Church on Lewis Avenue in Tulsa. My wife had a good job. She was teaching in the Union School District. I was doing freelance for Sooners Illustrated, and the guys there wanted to start magazines at other schools and offered me the position. I was going to work for them. I didn't own the magazine starting out.
Yeah.
And so I asked Bill, and he took me to the nicest restaurant in Tulsa, and right, we had a nice conversation about what it would be like to, you know, to do that kind of a job and go back to Arkansas. And he knew that, you know, my family would be excited. I'm talking about my wife's family, you know, would get to see their grandkids more. My dad didn't live in Fayetteville at that time. He'd moved to Malvern, so it wouldn't be like we were going to be neighbors. But we, you know, we'd be around them more, a little bit closer. And we had that conversation, and then Bill handed me an envelope with my name on it, typed, and says, I'm going to tell you this, but I want this in writing so that you can take it home and give it to Jean Ann, and she knows that it's serious. And he says, I'm going to retire in 6 months, and you'll be the sports editor. And I opened up, and that's what it said. It was a type note that he signed. And he says, I don't want you to think that this is a promise to make you stay that doesn't have some backing behind it.
Wow.
The owner of the newspaper has given me permission to give you this note. And I just, whoa, that changes everything. I mean, it is a great newspaper. And, you know, Bill had, you know, great staff. But here was my thought. So these were all my friends, you know, 20 guys that I worked with for 14 years. Mm-hmm. You go from being friends to being their boss. It's a different dynamic. And I knew that, you know, the Hogs Illustrated thing was going to be a one-man job. I didn't really want to be a boss. I didn't think I could. I didn't think I would be very good at that. You know, that running really the writing would not be important. You know, your administrative skills and ability to make assignments and what I saw happening was every decision that you made as a boss affected a whole family. You know, whether you worked a night, you didn't work a night, you worked Friday nights, you worked Saturday nights, mm-hmm. you were off on the weekends. Working for a morning newspaper means most of the staff is working till midnight. And so when people ask for days off or, you know, families are unhappy and, you know, who gets the primo assignments, who's going to the bowl games and who's, you know, who's getting to do all the top assignments. And I just kind of bailed on that part of it. So that's why it's kind of a, you know, chicken way out. It was more money.
It paid off.
Yeah. No, it was. And there had a really good friend, Ed Bashir, who is the guy that made Nolan's suits, made all the suits for all the coaches, had the best store. And he took me to lunch soon after that. And I was like, I don't know what to do. And he says, Clay, you'll never own the Tulsa World. You may own Hogs Illustrated if things fall right. And he says, you go and that doesn't work out, you can come back and you can sell suits for me. And he says, I'll pay you the same amount of money. And he never had intentions of doing that because he thought he would never, you know, I'd never be back in Tulsa again. And he was right. But that kind of gave me a little, okay, I'm going to start something. There'd been four or five attempts at Hogs Illustrated, not that title, but a Razorback, you know, monthly magazine.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they failed almost immediately. And so it wasn't like, oh, this is a surefire thing. And as you say, my dad, when I told him how we were going to do it, he goes, sounds a little dicey to me.
Talking about postage
reliability. Just getting you know, you're handing your life to the U.S. Postal Service. And Postal Service is better then than it was now. But, you know, you don't really want to depend on somebody else to deliver your product, you know. So, but it worked out.
So you mentioned initially not owning it, and then you owned it, and then you sold it again. Take us kind of through the timeline, Dudley, Otis, some other guys and gals that you've worked with along the way. How did Hogs Illustrated develop into the monster it is today?
Well, so I wrote early on. We had hardly any advertising. So if you've got a 48-page magazine and there's no advertising, man, you got to write a lot of stories. The more ads that you have, the less stories you have to write. You know, it's kind of a double-edged deal. Both you make more money with ads, and then you don't have to spend as much for content because you got less pages to fill. But I, you know, the first person that I called was Harry King. And he said he would contribute, you know, his content. And second person I called was Dudley. Somewhere down the line, I think I talked to Nate Allen. And then Otis was, it was a number of years later. You know, Dudley wrote both the football and basketball recruiting just like he is now. And then, you know, we added Otis for a while. And, Boy, early on, I was laying out the pages. I was editing the copy. I was writing, you know, 80% of it. I mean, the editing was really done poorly because I just didn't have a lot of time, mm-hmm. and I would churn out stuff. And the worst thing you can do The worst is to be your own copy editor. You will not catch your own mistakes. And, you know, I mean, so there would be mistakes in the magazine, which was embarrassing. And as we developed, and I was the owner after 2 years, and, you know, we started to build a little cash flow. Well, and I didn't write as many stories, and I spent more time editing. I can catch somebody else's mistakes. I just don't catch my own.
How big was sports radio to the growth of your magazine? You've talked about on air, in print, how winning helped grow the magazine. But when you
I'll never forget this, Ty. The, you know, Chuck asked me to do radio with him, and I think we just did one night, if I remember right. It was on an FM station.
Was it Monday nights?
I believe it was Monday nights.
Okay.
And that was pretty,
like 90,
that was about
96-ish.
Third or fourth year. 92 is when we started, so it's about 95, 96.
Yeah.
And started doing radio with Chuck, and it was just in Northwest Arkansas. And then he flipped the switch and went statewide with ARN, you know, and how it was on about 10 or 12 stations, if I remember right. You know, a lot of little AMs. And we had an ad guy that was struggling. He was selling some ads, but it was cold calling, and people had never heard of the magazine, in both in Little Rock and in Northwest Arkansas. I mean, we had some advertising, and he came in, it wasn't probably 6 weeks after we'd started doing statewide radio on, you know, and I was on three nights a week with Chuck at that particular time. And he says, man, everywhere I went, it was a hit. And I said, what do you mean?
He started making that commission, didn't he?
He said, they knew who Hogs Illustrated was. And he says, we sold. And so I told Chuck, I said, this was a major deal. And of course, he flips it around and he says, well, you going with me was a major deal for him.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm always... I realize what a great decision that was to do radio. And, you know, Ty, there wasn't a lot of money in it. I can't remember what Chuck paid. But if he'd let me do that for free, it would have been worthwhile. And it just, you know, things just exploded. And, you know, one thing led to another. Then the magazine had grown so big, and the advent of the internet meant that you worked every day. There weren't any, you know, you didn't have the summer off like you did early. We didn't print in the summer. And then all at once, it's basically, you know, you got to have a story up all the time. So you might be writing something two or three times a day. And it had gotten so big, and I felt like it had just swallowed me up. And we were doing a deal with a local charter company for airline taking private planes to the football games. And I would take six or seven advertisers and a photographer. And then the other seats in the plane, it was a Citation jet. I think it was nine seats. So I had seven seats that I would put an advertiser, and I'd get them a game ticket, say at Alabama, and they'd go with me. And we'd have a van on the tarmac, go to the game. As soon as the game's over, we're back in the plane coming home. And I had we were having to pick up advertisers in Little Rock, and I had a guy cancel at the last minute, and I called Harry King, who was working for Stevens.
Mm-hmm.
I said, do you want to – he was going to drive to the game. I said, you want to hop on the plane? I'll have you back, you know, Saturday night. And he's like, you're going to do what? I said, this is the way I'm traveling, not going commercial. And so he went, and we're on the plane on the way back, and he says, you know, Stevens has got Falcon jets. And I said, yeah. You know, it'd be nice to work for a company like that. And he goes, yeah, it's pretty good. And he said, would you sell? I said, well, I never had thought about it. But I said, you know, I don't even know what it's worth. You know, the magazine.
Yeah.
And I got a call from somebody at Stevens that following Monday, and it took us about 6 months to do the due diligence and put things together. But that was, I probably would have just kept doing what I was doing if they hadn't called, because I just don't know. I mean, you need to be careful who you you know, you sell too. And I didn't want to be without a job. And they were like, you'd still be the publisher and we'd want you to write. But the circulation, the business part, the selling it, you know, all those jobs that were just eating me up would be erased. And I could just write and manage the editorial staff.
Now, what are you going to do?
You're listening to Trusting the Process.
Now, I know people like to play at the idea that Warren Stevens is the reason they keep playing games in Little Rock. You've kind of refuted that. You've been open on air. I don't know if you've ever said it in print. What is your relationship with him lended into the knowledge and just the insider talk with just kind of how things orchestrate within the state of Arkansas?
Well, knowing Warren, that he's not putting pressure on anybody that way. I mean, whether he would like that, that'd be obvious. He lives in Little Rock. And, you know, they've got a business that's centrally located. I mean, it's the biggest off Wall Street, you know, investment banking firm in the world. So, but he is not that kind of guy. And I just know him in the conversations that we've had. Never once has it ever been mentioned to me of, you know, of course, I don't work for him anymore. So, I mean, I have nothing to gain by saying that. Haven't for, you know, for what, 12 years. Mm-hmm. But that's not what he does. That's not how he operates. And it's not what he wants to do. And he lets other people worry about those type things. And just, you know, now it all goes back to his thought that he did, you know, have a confrontation with Coach Broyles. Oh, what was that? You know, 02, 03, somewhere in there. And there was, you know, some thought that, you know, they were going to do an expansion of the stadium, but Coach Broyles wouldn't give them enough game to make that worthwhile. But, I think, you know, Warren, he spent his time worrying about other stuff after that. And, you know, that's my thought. And other people that know him well say the same things. But you can't. You know, people have their perceptions and they don't change. You know, it's like it's going to be what people say till the end of time.
Yeah.
And I get that. But I don't feel that's the way he works.
Now I've got about 20 more questions here, but I'm going to be a man of my word. We're coming up on 45 minutes. Now you brought up Frank Broyles, and we haven't talked a lot about him in this podcast so far. But I do want to hear about the time that you almost blew up his house with the chemistry set.
Well, it wasn't – that's not really what happened. But I was probably 10 or 12, and Coach Broyles hosted the media after games. And I think there was other people besides my dad that would go, but he had steak dinner Saturday night after day games in Fayetteville. Of course, there weren't any lights for years and years in Fayetteville, so they were all day games. Coach Broyles got four sons, two daughters, and – you know, there's a couple of sons that are around my age. Well, we weren't part of the dinner. We'd be downstairs in the basement. I say the basement, you know, there are bedrooms downstairs. And I think it was with Dan. And he and I were messing around with a chemistry set that he had gotten for his birthday, I think. And we made a smoke bomb. And we were going to take it outside, but it got set off prematurely, and a little bit of it got on a curtain, and so there was smoke billowing up from the curtain. The curtain was not on fire. There was no fire. There was nothing on fire except the smoke bomb. And of course, the smoke filtered up through the house, and the fire department came, and it was a bad deal for me and for Dan. And my mother and dad were, you know, they're going to discipline me. And Mrs. Broyles, Barbara, I said, I've already handled that. And Dan and I, we got administered some punishment in the backyard.
Some paddled?
It was some punishment. I'll just put it that way.
Okay.
I'm not going to put it on her what she did, but my mother and father were convinced that that what they what she did was had been enough.
Was enough. Well, Clay, it's been enjoyable. A little past 45 minutes, so I try to keep it as concise as
possible. So the fish are waiting. Thank you very much.
The fish are waiting. Clay Henry, publisher of Hogs Illustrated, Season 1, Episode 8 of Trusting the Process. Make sure you're subscribing to the Hit That Line podcast network, brought to you by Breen RV Center. For Clay Henry, I'm Ty Richardson. Make sure you're always trusting the process.
Long range! Are you kidding me?
He's got his J back, folks, and the eye of the tiger.